Welcome to science class. Day 4.
I want to thank Keith for the prayer. Can I move this over a little bit? Or would you? It's one thing I'd recommend to you if you don't do this. Before you ever get up to present to the body of Christ, you should pray.
Amen.
I always do that. And not to brag on myself, I do that because I need help. I really do. And I feel much more comfortable if I know that I have the Spirit and God on my side. And today I got a double dose, so this is going to be great. Before I start, I should mention that I lost a $20 bill, so you happen to see that. There was a comment in the box, and I want to kind of start with that. And it was, I think if I take it right, it was kind of maybe a recommendation for me to kind of... I hope just embolden a point I made yesterday, because I think I kind of made the point, at least I hope I did, because it was kind of one of the main points I wanted to get out there, but maybe just to embolden it a little bit more. So I kind of wrote up our introductory quiz here on that. I started, and I gave kind of like a 2,000 year of where I could find a reference to some kind of an analogy. Remember what that analogy was? The watchmaker analogy, and what has kind of resurfaced, I guess, recently, because of the Expelled movie, that came out of that watchmaker analogy, the concept of what?
Intelligent design,
right? And so we went through that, and I tried to make a point about that term, either the watchmaker or intelligent design. What was my point that I tried to make on that? That I hope you agreed with. You might not have, but yeah. Let's not rename God. Let's not lower God to and put other names on Him. We all of us here can have designed things intelligently, right? And so we kind of put God into our dimensions, right? And I think this is kind of a problem. And so I read a whole bunch of quotes by various people that were using the watchmaker analogy and how the intelligent design kind of came out of that. And I also, I hope I did, in there made some points that I didn't quite agree with some of those people. The quotes that I used, for the most part, we're showing that there's a belief, and I think this is an innate thing that God put in us. We're not made after kinds. We are made in the image of God, and I think there is an innate thing in us that makes us just, no matter how badly we do not want to believe in God, there's always that gnawing thing there that says this is too unbelievable without it. And I think that's in everybody. Now, some people don't take that nearly as far as enough. And a lot of the people that I quoted, some of them we would be pretty much in line with. But there were a lot of them that if you read more of their works, you would find that we have some disagreements with them. I mentioned Cicero, right? He was polytheistic. And obviously we don't agree. He was talking about watchmakers. We mentioned, the one I definitely mentioned, I know, was Thomas Paine. And we disagreed with him. You remember why we disagreed with what his comment was? I could have put these back up and made it easier for you, but yeah, he acted like Jesus wasn't involved. Well, that is really some of the belief of several of those that I use. And I didn't go into that point because that's not the kind of the point I was making, but it's been suggested maybe I make that point a little more stronger. A lot of those people, several of those people, were what we call deists. And a lot of times we put a lot of stock into our forefathers in our nation. A lot of times we have really some nationalistic pride. And don't get me wrong, I am so thankful that I live in this country. I am. And every time I talk about this, I always feel people are going to be mad at me because I don't respect people that have went to wars and died. I do. But boy, are we arrogant in our country. You know, 200 and some years, I mean, what do we have in the Roman Empire? You know, I mean, sometimes people think, well, let's look in Revelation, see where America is. You know, is it in there? I mean, why would who are we? You know, and sometimes we really kind of put some people on high pedestals, especially some of the founders of our country, who I respect in certain ways, but they had some problems. They really had some problems. And most of them, almost across the board, were deists. John Adams and James Madison and Ben Franklin and Thomas Jefferson was probably the worst. What deism is, just so we are straight here, and really the watchmaker analogy is, this was kind of the point that was made, the watchmaker analogy kind of comes out of deism. It really does. It's the idea that God has started everything like a watch, and it's just winding down, and he has absolutely no interaction with us since he created everything. Now, sometimes I've said that, and some people go, well, yeah, it kind of makes sense. Think about that. What does that mean? Anybody, go ahead. I'll take a comment. What does that mean if God has not had any interaction with us? Jesus is not the Son of God. He wasn't miraculously born. He wasn't resurrected. And if he's not resurrected, we read in Corinthians, if he's not resurrected, what's the point? What resurrection, what hope do we have to look forward to? And so there's that deism view that our country was really founded on. It came straight out of that age of reason, age of enlightenment. That's what it came right out of that. It's a result of those things. And Thomas Jefferson was really one of the worst. He actually took literally a razor blade and took the Gospels or the four Gospels, which he felt weren't done very well. And he took a razor blade and literally cut out all the verses and rearranged them into basically all the conversations of Jesus, because Jesus was a moral man and had good moral teachings. But it started with his birth, which mentioned nothing about a virgin birth or angels or anything. And it ended in, I wrote it down, I looked it up this morning, Mark 15:46. I think there's another version of it in John that is basically the end of his Bible. He made a Bible. There's a Jefferson Bible. And it ends in Mark 15:46, which says that they rolled the stone up against the tomb and went away. That's how his Bible ends. Because it rejects all supernatural things. It rejects any kind of miracles, any kind of interaction with God in our lives. And that's a real problem. And so now the watchmaker analogy was used by some of these people, which we do kind of really have align our faith with, but some of them were not, and that's kind of the way they were thinking about it. So is that clear on that point? I'm trying to make the point of the watchmaker was, the good point of it is that, you know, you look at things and we are without excuse. And that's, if you remember the last quote, we did a whole bunch of quotes of people. Do you remember the last one we did? It's very important that you remember the last one, because that's the one that I said was the only one that was inspired. Remember who said it? Paul. Remember where it was? Romans 1 and 20, and I'll just read that here just to iterate the point here. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. And really, that's the quote I wanted you to remember. That was the main one. That's the inspired quote about how that we are without excuse when we deny God and we see the things around us that he has made. Any comments on that point? I just want to make sure that's really... I tried to make some of that point, but I probably could have made that a little bit better with that. So, yeah, Tom.
Yeah, I agree with what you're saying. So could you emphasize the start of that passage where it says that God's wrath is revealed from him? And how that ties into all this?
I shouldn't have closed it as you started talking. He wants. We're going to go a little bit back further in Romans 1. We're going to go to verse 18. You want me to go a little further before that, or you want to start with 18?
18.
The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. And suppress the truth by their wickedness. I think is that the phrase you really want? I mean, that's, to me, a big one. And we want to, and since, I'll read it the whole thing. The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them because God has made it plain to them. And then we go on with the other things. And that's some of the stuff we want to look at today is, when we're going through here, we want to look at the consequences of evolution. And I'm not trying to be mocking here. I just think it's very ironic that if you ever are in the unfortunate circumstances of having to listen to Richard Dawkins, you know, he's from Britain, and have you ever heard him talk about evolution? This is exactly what he says. Evolution, he's always saying that. Every time he says it, I just kind of snicker. I go, yes, very good, very good. Keep telling us that, because that's what it is. And so I used his pronunciology, and that's all I did there. I wasn't mocking anybody or anything, so I wouldn't do that. Okay, they receive a reward. There's a reward for believing this, and that's one of the things we definitely want to discuss today is what this reward is of following this and having this mindset that God is out of our lives. There is no creation. We reject it all, and we are all just survival of the fittest, all in the animal kingdom, all battling together to survive, doing what you ever want to do is completely acceptable. Okay. All right. So, just in some review, we had the principles of geology, which laid out the principle of uniformitarianism, the things that, however rates things are going today, is how they've always been going. We got that from Peter, and that was Charles Lyell that wrote that book, and that was the Bible for Darwin, and he used that to write his book on the origin of species by means of natural selection, the preservation of favored races, and the struggle for life. Charles Darwin, 1859. Very influenced by that. There really have been multiple theories of evolution. The problem is that Darwinism, as it existed at his time, it's no one believes in anymore. It had to be changed because of all the... I mean, no one believes in it. Even the evolutionists know that pure Darwinism, the way he spelled it out, doesn't work. Because after we just didn't know a whole lot back then. And so we know a lot more about life and biology and the complexity of life. We talked about irreducible complexity yesterday. And so the theories of evolution have had to change to be able to still hold on to their belief that they want to hold on to so deeply. So there's actually several different kinds of theories that we have out there. We want to kind of look at some of those today. Now, I believe there are several different kinds of theories because they have to... You know, you have to have one theory to explain what this one can't do, but this one can explain what this one can't do, and you know, you have, what's this hand doing? What's this hand doing? You know, this is the way evolution works, and it always reminds me of Mark Twain's quote, it's easier to tell the truth. How come? Remember what you said, right? You don't have to remember what you said if you can tell the truth. But there is amazing disagreement, really, even between many evolutionists. But you know, have no doubt, they're united in one thing. They're united against you, and they're united against Jesus Christ and His creation. So we want to we're going to do more biology today. You ready? Science. We learned a lot about genetics after Darwin wrote his book, and we have this genetic code, right? We have information, literal genetic code. Even evolutionists call it the blueprint for life. That's really funny if you think about it. And they even, the blueprint for life, the blueprint, like blueprint plans or information, and it's all encoded in DNA, right? What's DNA stand for? Deoxyribonucleic acid. How's it different than RNA? Deoxy, right? Which means it has less oxygen. That's one of the main differences. There's several differences, but one of the main differences is that it just has some less oxygen in it. And we have, it's a ladder, kind of spiral ladder, and we have these nitrogen bases that all go together. And some of you can remember how these all go together. We have our adenine, it goes with thymine, they always match up. And cytosine goes with guanine, they always match up. And we can have this sequencing of letters, and we can have a little section of the DNA which is called a gene. And that is coding, it's information for like a lot of different traits that you have, like whether you have blue eyes or brown eyes or things like this. And this DNA then is wound up in these things called chromosomes. And how many chromosomes do we have? How many chromosomes do each of you have right now in your cells? How many? 46, right? 46 chromosomes, that means how many pairs? 23. We have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Okay? So 46 total. And 22 of the pairs are called the autosomes. And there's one special pair, right, which is called the sex chromosomes that determines whether you're going to be male or female. And the sex chromosomes kind of look a little bit different. There's XX, right? And the reason those are X's is because these chromosomes kind of actually look like X's, okay? As you saw in the... If I can go back, can I? Yeah, the like those X's right there, the chromosomes, they kind of look like X's. But one of them could kind of look a little bit shorter, and that's a Y chromosome. So if you have this possibility, you're a female, and if you have XY, then you're a male. So this is an amazing thing. It's just an amazing process how this works. You have 46 chromosomes total, and you get how many of those from your father? Half of them, right? And you get the other half from your mother, and it's kind of random which half of theirs you get. They come together, and so you can have some real uniqueness even within a family. The children of my youth are a little bit more dark-skinned and apparently seem to have some more genetics from Ginger. But the children of my old age are really cute. And both red-headed and, you know, fairly fair-skinned, and probably will be freckly maybe later too. I don't know. But and it's just kind of random, kind of how which kind of genetic information came from me or came from my wife, and it comes together. So we have and remember how this happens? There's cell division, right? There's what happens when your cells just we need to have more cells because we have like a lot of cells in our body, and sometimes you know, there goes some cells, and I need to regenerate cells, and so I need to make new cells that still have my 46 chromosomes in them. What is that process called? Who knows this? What is it? Mitosis. Very good. Mitosis. And mitosis is just the cells will duplicate, and so all 46 chromosomes that I have in my body, 23 I got from my mom and 23 I got from my dad, those came together to make 46 chromosomes. I can have that cell duplicate a lot, and it makes just other cells with my exact same genetic code. But if I'm going to give half of my genetic code to my three sons and my daughter, then that's another process. Instead of a cell replicating to make another cell with 46 chromosomes, I need to have a cell that is only that only has half of my genetic code. And it doesn't matter what half, randomly. It could take the first chromosome, the second, the first, the second. You know, it could be kind of, there's a lot of possibilities there if you mathematically think it through. What's that process called? Meiosis, right? Or meiosis. I think meiosis, I actually always say meiosis too, but I'm not really sure. Actually, Nikki put a pronunciation on there. It looks like it's meiosis, though. So. Okay, so mitosis is a type of cell division that results in two daughter cells, each having the same number and kind of chromosomes as the parent nucleus, typical of ordinary tissue growth. Meiosis is a type of cell division that results in two daughter cells, each with half the chromosome number of the parent cell, as in the production of gametes. So what are we talking about here when we say gametes? We're talking about... Go ahead, you can say it. Eggs and sperm. Okay, this is the female produces eggs, and those eggs are haploid cells. They don't have all 46 of your chromosomes in it. They have a kind of a random 23 that are in there. And if you're a female, the last pair, remember the 23rd pair? Which chromosome did you give? An X. You have no choice. You are all giving the X, right? But if for me, sperm, I have half of my chromosomes there, and in that 23rd one, I could be either giving a X or a Y, right? The fathers decide what the children are going to be, right? If I give an X, that's going to go with my wife's X, and we're going to get a daughter. If I give three Ys with my three X's from my wife, I'm going to get three sons. Okay? Which is what I chose to do. No, you don't really have much choice in that, right? What's the probabilities on that? Technically, it's 50-50, supposed to be. in certain societies is actually a little bit different, and it's, we might talk about that a little bit tomorrow. It's not much different, but it could be slightly a little different. Okay, so this is I think amazing. Because one of my favorite verses is Genesis 2:24, and Genesis 2:24 says, you know, that man will leave father and mother, they will be united with his wife and become what?
One
flesh. Now, I like that because there's a lot of verses in the Bible that really, there's, if you really look into it, there's a whole bunch of meanings you can use. Now, normally we use that for, well, that verse in particular has a lot of different meanings, doesn't it? A lot of times we refer it to as marriage, right? You know, marriage, the joined together of husband and wife. You can even think of it as in the sexual way, we join together, we become one. But we think of it a lot of times as marriage, but we know in the New Testament, you know, it's referred to as, you know, this is a mystery. I'm actually referring to the church, too. So there's a lot of different meanings in this. And ironically, a lot of times the one we don't use would be the literal meaning, really, if you think about it. Man and woman come together to become one flesh. And isn't that exactly what happens? We are one flesh. One flesh has how many chromosomes? For humans, 46, right? So we have 23 from the male, 23 from the female. It comes together literally. We can do a literal translation of this. To become one flesh. This is how it happens. And it takes a male and a female to do that. To make one flesh. We're going to look a little bit more at genetics. We're going to look at kind of one of those things that John Lee was trying to make the other night. We call him a Punnett square in the way we were using it. There's actually a term for we do that in education a lot with him. We put all these things. We have quadrant A, quadrant B teaching styles, and I don't really understand all that stuff. So this is a Punnett square. You remember Punnett squares? We're going to try to keep it somewhat simple on this because really gene expression in our it's a lot more complicated than just this. I mean, there's a lot of genes can control a lot of different things. A lot of times we do eye color and we talk about blue or brown. Well, there's other colors of eyes, right? And so it's a lot more complicated than just sometimes where we take a certain gene with two alleles. We'll just use this example here. I saw this Punnett square on the internet. I saw storks and I thought that's kind of cute because, you know, in a couple of years, my two sons, you know, will be asking that question, you know. And I was thinking, you know, little Charlie Darwin asking his dad that question. Where do storks come from? You're right. They didn't get it. So I thought that joke was amazing. And I told my son and he laughed and he goes, people aren't going to think that's funny. I thought I'd try it anyway. Where do storks come from? Never mind. Okay. So we have a blue stork and a red stork. So we're going to keep it kind of simple, but it works this way for some things. It just sometimes is a little bit more complicated. We have a blue stork and a red stork, and the blue, we'll say it's the father. The blue father is what we call homozygous dominant for blue. He has a capital A and a capital A. Okay? Now, what if he had a capital A? So because he has these two possible genes that he's going to give one of those to his offspring, right? There's going to be an offspring. It's going to be one of them. It's going to be kind of random which one he gets. But in this case, he's homozygous dominant, so no matter what, he's given what to his offspring? He's given the dominant allele of the gene, right? The dominant, or the A. Now, maybe he's heterozygous blue, which means you have a capital A and a small a, okay? The small a is recessive, is what we call recessive, and the bigger one is what we call dominant. Now, if he was capital A, small a, what color would that stork be?
Blue.
He'd still be blue, right? We see how this works. Some of you might not have heard this the first time ever. Okay, he'd still be blue because it's that one gene is dominant over the other one. The other one doesn't express itself in what we call the phenotype of how you end up kind of looking. These are what we call the genotypes, what the actual alleles are. But he could be heterozygous, and so he'd still be blue, but he'd be giving, he has a 50-50 chance of whether he's given his offspring the dominant or the recessive. So this red stork is homozygous also, recessive. Homozygous meaning, maybe I should clarify that. What's the homozygous mean?
Like.
They're like or they're the same. They both are little A's. This is both big A's. So no matter what, they're both homozygous. One's homozygous dominant, one's homozygous recessive. You get this? Is this okay? That's not like authenticated with those things. And it could be just as confusing for both of us. So, but I got to keep picking on Mike because that Calypso song will not leave my head. I sing it all the way here. I sing it all the way home. So I think it's because I enjoy it, but it's stuck in there and could be there for a while. Okay. So we make a Punnett square to show the possibilities of what the offspring will have. And so we can take these and put them in the boxes, right?
Yes.
Right, John? We can do that, can't we? That was kind of difficult, wasn't it? There. We can do that. Okay? So. Now, I'm going to say straight out, I didn't do this. This was brought to me last night, brought to me and my wife, and we thought it was funny. So we said you can keep it in there, and it's kind of mean, but I will tell you that John Lee, I'll tell you, Charles, this is important for you because my son has been listening to your talk about family and respecting your father and honor and all these things. And John Lee came to my son and bribed him to put some nefarious slides into my PowerPoint when I wasn't watching. And he decided not to do it and decided to do this instead. So that's loyalty, and I appreciate. Thank you. Right. Shout out. Shout out to my son. Okay. Apparently, John was wanting to put a picture of a bell at the end of my thing so that I knew when I would be done. I'm not sure I totally trust my son. He might try to do that later on for John anyway, so he respects John about as much. So no. Yes. Yes. I should have never called on you. Okay. All right. So, if you see how this works out, then no matter what, these offspring are going to be what? They're all going to be blue. 100% blue. Now, and also, their genotype is 100% heterozygous for blue, right? And so, and I thought maybe we should have made several more of these and done other options, but let's say that blue one was actually heterozygous. I don't know if we can just do this in our mouth without seeing this visually. Let's say the blue one was heterozygous, big A, small a. Okay? Then what would the offspring be? Can you think of that? What would it be? If this one was big A, little a, big A, little a, and this is little a, little a, then all this is going to be big A, little a, big A, little a. They're going to be what?
Blue.
And this is going to be little a, little a, and little a, little a. They're going to be
red.
So it's going to be 50-50. Right? 50% of them will be blue, 50% of them will be red. Okay? We'll make it even more complicated. Let's say that they're both heterozygous. They're both blue storks. So we have capital A, small a, and a capital A, small a. Okay? So what will this be?
Are they heterozygous for red?
They're heterozygous. They can't be heterozygous for red. Right? Is there a better said? They cannot be heterozygous for red because red is the recessive here in this analogy here. So if you're going to have a red stork, it's going to be little a, little a. So no matter what, they're going to be, if they're homozygous blue or heterozygous blue, but they can only be homozygous red, right? So we're going to have homozygous two blue storks, or heterozygous, sorry, two blue storks, a big A and a small a. Is this making sense, or am I going to waste my time? Are some people with me? All right, so a capital A and a small a, and a capital A and a small a. So right here, what are you going to have? Two big A's, which means it's going to be blue homozygous, right? This will be a small a and a big A, heterozygous blue. This will be a big A and a small a, right? Heterozygous blue. And then you'll have a small a and a small a, homozygous red. Good, I'm hearing enough mumblings that make me feel somewhat good about my teaching. Okay, so we have three of the four children, if we had four children, three of the four children would be blue, and the fourth one would be red. Does it always work out that way?
No.
You know, talk to Jeremy Morris. It doesn't work out that way, right? It's really funny. In my sister's family, Vern Engel, who is my elder, and I considered almost one of my grandfathers, he had 13 grandchildren. just like Jacob's children. He had 12 grandsons and one granddaughter. I preferred the granddaughter over the other, all the grandsons. Now, that's pretty amazing, really, if you think about that. 12 grandsons and then one granddaughter, just like Jacob's children. And then, but the granddaughter now has had three boys. And think about Jeremy and Tim, you know, and Ginger's brother has three girls, and but a lot of them have a lot of girls. What's Ben have? I don't know why I'm talking about this, but I just always think that's revenge, maybe. I don't know. probably it's Cindy Morris's revenge. Okay, so that's kind of how the genetics kind of work on this. So there's variety. There's variety. We can have variety. We can have kids that, you know, don't quite look like our other kids. We can have variety within life. That's important to understand that. Let's just look at another Punnett square here that has to do with kind of the sex chromosomes. So whenever we do this, we're going to have, obviously, a male crossing with a female. We're not going to have any other kind of Punnett square up there regarding sexes. It doesn't work. Okay? So we have XX, which is the female. So the female is going to give an X or an X. That's the only options. The male is going to be XY. It's going to give either an X or a Y. And this, so we can do a cross here, and we can get XX. We'll do the cross here. We can get XX, XX across the top, and XY, XY on the bottom. And so we're always going to, for males and females, always going to be 50%. That's what the sex chromosomes will always come out. I threw this one on here just because there's some genes that are on the X and Y chromosomes. There's very few genes that are on the Y chromosome, but there are some genes that are on the X chromosome that will come out. And one of these is color blindness. And there's different kinds of color blindness, so there could be different ways to explain kind of some of this. But it's color blindness is a sex-linked, or what we call an X-linked gene, because it's on the X chromosome. And so if you're a male, you have an X and a Y, right? If that gene is on the X chromosome and you get it, you're going to be colorblind, right? You have no choice. Now, will the daughters be colorblind? Not necessarily, because this is a recessive thing. So if we have a woman here that she's a carrier of the colorblind gene, she won't be colorblind. And she's marrying a husband that is not colorblind, then they could have, all their daughters will not be colorblind. All their daughters will not be colorblind because that one X will dominate the X that has the colorblind on it. But 50% of her sons will be. So a lot of times the X-linked or sex-linked chromosomes a lot of times will show up in males rather than the females. We can talk about this all day long and on some other different things. So, okay, any questions about that kind of the biology part of it there? Okay, yeah. Baldness. I officially left that out on purpose. So, apparently that's supposed to come through your mother's father, but I'm balder than my grandpa. So, I mean, I feel I'm probably past that point. So, but Charles is happy to know that this is all natural. Okay. That was another comment I got in my box about people being blinded by the reflection. So, but I'm pretty sure I know who put that in there. So, okay. So I apologize. So under certain environmental conditions, this is kind of how evolution kind of, we're still talking about evolution here. Under certain environmental conditions, certain characteristics might prove to be more beneficial than others. And I'll tell you, there's parts of evolution I don't have a whole lot of problems with because I see evidence. You can see evidence of some of these things. You could have certain environmental characteristics, certain things that would help something maybe survive a little bit more than others, give an organism a better chance of survival. So that when it reproduces, its genes will have a better chance of being passed on. So I'll just do a made-up analogy. My kids of my old age have red hair. Let's say that they lived on a planet. And this is going to be kind of a far-fetched thing, but I think it'll probably make sense, I hope. Let's say they live on a planet like Mars, which is red. And there's some man-eating flying monster that's flying around. This is starting to get far-fetched, but it still is analogous, I think. And that eats humans, okay? Well, if you can imagine from the bird's eye view, my kids might have a better chance of survival, wouldn't they? Because the bird's eye or the dragon eye or whatever it is view of looking down might not see them because they have a red top. And so they'd eat all the other things. And eventually then, when my sons grow up and get married, chances are they'll probably marry what? A red-headed girl, because they survived the dragon onslaught also. Okay? And so then there's a really good chance that our offspring will have red hair and have a variety maybe of reddishness. And of course, some of that reddishness might be just a little bit more matching of the red surface of the planet. And so their offspring might be even more closely a different shade of red that's just a little bit more perfect, because there's a little bit of genetic variation in these things. And so eventually you could have a population of people that have red hair about the same color as the planet, right? Okay? And then eventually, if you throw enough time at it, they would turn into red salamanders. You see, was the analogy good? Or did I lose you there at the end? Okay? And this might have been an absurd analogy, but it's not really. That is what we're talking about. We're talking about, we can go a long ways with them, you know, and so that makes sense, you know, you can have variation within something. But how are we going to get to this? How are we going to just change species completely? This is very difficult to see. And this is what evolution, this is where evolution jumps off the deep end. What animal did Darwin derive his theory from? Finches? Okay. Ironically, he mentioned birds. If you had the origin of species and you could do like a word search, a word find on it, you won't even find the word finches in the entire thing. A lot of people think it's all about finches. He wrote about birds. He wrote about all kinds of animals and things on there. Later on, some people kind of told him what he thought those kind of things might have been. Really, Darwin got almost all his ideas from his grandfather, Erasmus, who had already written about all these lies, thinking they were interesting and telling his grandson about these things. He grew up with hearing some of those things. So it's much later on where someone wrote a book called Darwin's Finches. And ever since then, everybody has really always thought that it was all about his books, all about explaining how these finches have evolved and things like this, where he didn't really even mention the word finches. He did talk about various birds and things, but he saw these finches or birds on the Galapagos Islands, and he examined them. He didn't really even notice any of this. He just took specimens back. Some people pointed it out to him later, and then he started trying to put all this together. But at the time when he was observing, he didn't really even notice. Because the problem is, these finches really look a lot alike. They're basically almost all the same size. They're basically almost all the same color. There's only just some slight difference in the sizes of their beaks. These are his drawings, so I mean, you can see. I mean, it's hard to tell. I mean, that one actually kind of looks like just more a blown-up version than that one, that Xerox copy or something. But there's very little difference. They're all finches, still. They're all finches. He didn't watch them and see that they turned into the Galapagos turtles, which is a much more interesting animal that's on there. They had some different sized beaks, and they noticed that they could have some different functions on what they would eat. Now, did they evolve those beaks to meet those functions, or did they just use those functions because that's what their beaks were good for? You know, that to me, that's even debatable right there. I mean, you can debate that, but in the end, they're still finches. We have to make a huge leap of faith to jump into an entire species change, something else. And anyway, through 1977 to 1982, they had a big drought, and they noticed that a lot of the birds with bigger beaks were a little bit better off. They could fend themselves off and things. And so eventually, in that like 5-year period, all the finches had big beaks. And when the drought ended, you know, they came back. So, you know, this is his example of evolution. Well, it's a lot faster than what he was hoping it would be. I mean, these things change a lot. These things can change pretty quickly. You know, some of these just real, you know, within the species, or within the, and I keep saying species, and I shouldn't say that, because we are confused on the way we're trying to divide things up. I want to say kinds, because that's the biblical taxonomy is what it is. Kinds is what God made them, and I'm not even really sure exactly what God meant totally by kinds on which one that would fit in with our family genus species, how that would do. But our mechanism of organizing things is pretty poor, in my opinion, especially since we're in the animal kingdom. That's a poor way to categorize us. Another example, and I want to put this one up there because I would almost guarantee that some of you have seen this maybe in a book. You heard about the peppered moths, right? This is like a classic, you know, example of what we're talking about, you know, on different kinds of transition species and things like this. The peppered moths are basically range from a range of white to black is what they do. And during the Industrial Revolution, they found out that, you know, there was a lot more pollution in the air and it was dark on the trees and stuff. And so all the moths ended up becoming black because the white moths on the black tree got eaten, right? The birds could see them. And then eventually they got things cleaned up a little bit, and then the white moths started coming back, and they talk about, see, we have genetic variation, and we can take this, and we can see that we can make something new. That's you're always making that big jump, huge jump. It makes sense up to this place, but I put this picture on here on purpose, because some of, if you see, this is like almost all biology textbooks, they always use the peppered moth. It's like their favorite one. And you'll see a picture like this, and I got this out of a textbook. And you'll see, I don't know, it's kind of dark, but so you can probably only see the white one. But there's a black moth right here, there's a white moth right there, right? There was a lot of controversy on these because whenever you see a picture like that, those things are super glued to the tree. I don't have a problem with that because, this process, you know, it makes sense. This is an okay process, and you're very rarely going to actually be able to go along and, ooh, check it out, two pepper moths right next to the same tree, and you can see the white one, you can't see the black one. You're not going to see that, so they have to kind of stage these pictures. But every time you see that peppered moth picture, they've and they do this with a lot of different things to get pictures for biology books. And it's not always like Ernst Haeckel and being importantly deceiving, but you have to kind of stage that picture to get that kind of thing like we do for 4-H. We stage pictures and stuff. So.
But isn't it also part of the story that they don't normally rest on tree trunks? They normally rest on the underside of leaves.
I don't even know that.
I believe that's the case.
Okay. All right. Charles said that they a lot of times they're not even on tree trunks. They're underneath leaves, which would be a real problem for the birds trying to see them too. So plus they're on green. So, and they haven't changed green, I don't think. So, okay. All right. Okay. So what we're talking about here is the difference between what we call microevolution and macroevolution. This is important because a lot of people say, well, you don't believe in evolution? Well, what about pepper moths? You know, and then you kind of look stupid if you deny something that you can see sometimes subtle changes and varieties in different things. So microevolution is, and these are my definitions, I use kinds here, variation within kinds. You can have variations within kinds. We have different kinds of cattle. Are they the same kind of cattle that we've had that came off of the ark? Well, probably not. There's Limousin and there's the Charolais, which come from France, and we have different kinds of variation within kinds of cattle. Macroevolution, though, is where we make our big jump, where we take kinds becoming other kinds. We can have enough of this variation that all of a sudden we can have a complete jump into something completely different. And there's a huge leap of faith. That's what it is. It's a leap of faith to go from microevolution into macroevolution. Once we knew about this Punnett squares and genetics through Gregory Mendel and some other people, we realized that Darwin's old evolutionary theory wasn't going to quite work. They have a hard time jumping from one kind to another kind just on the genetic variation that my son might look different than my other son. And they realized that probably is not going to work. So now what we have is new Darwinism or neo-Darwinism, that evolution is not just by the inherited characteristics, still it has to be by the inheritance, but by gene mutation also, that we need to have all these mutations. And remember the little analogy I had made where we went from Hebrews 13:8, Jesus Christ saying yesterday, today, and forever, to Carl Sagan's, the cosmos is all there ever is, all there ever was, all there ever will be. We have to have these gene mutations that would happen that would put some kind of a beneficial trait that could be selected for. And you need a lot of mutations, and they all have to be good. That's the thing. And they're never good. They're never good. All kinds of, mostly all mutations that we have are what we call deleterious mutations. They delete from our once perfectness. Now, don't get me wrong. God made a perfect creation. And it didn't take us long at all to ruin it and to subject it to frustration. And it has been decaying ever since. But neo-Darwinism says we need a lot of gene mutation to kind of make this work. In 1972, there was a new theory proposed because of another major problem, which I want to talk about in a little bit. I want to kind of state out the problem first, and then we'll talk about it in class. And I didn't even hear about this. And apparently, it was supposed to already be accepted. I was talking to Doug the other day. You know, there's bad things about the Internet. But there are some good things about the Internet, too, where people can quickly find some information on whether things are really true, if everybody believes them or not. You know, 20 years ago, when I was in my evolution class at Iowa, you know, I had this guy up telling me stuff that I couldn't, you know, it would have been really hard for me to go and find books, because there was no Internet, you know. Did you know that? There used to be a world where there was no Internet. And it wasn't before the flood. It was like just a while ago. You know, and can you even believe that? Doesn't that seem? I was like, what did I do without the Internet? I would PowerPoints. Oh my goodness. But where was I going with that? Let's see, the Internet. Oh yeah. So I was talking to Doug and how valuable it can be for us to now quickly know information. You know, I took notes on Ernst Haeckel's lie, which had already been admitted that it was a lie, and that teacher told me that. You know, and I wonder. I'd like to go find him. And asked, did you really know that it was actually a lie when you were telling us that? Or did you not know because you didn't have the Internet and know? You know, I mean, it's one or the other. So what is it? And it's really bothered me ever since that class that he lied to me on that. And he lied to me on transition fossils, which apparently there's already a theory that was supposed, evolutionary theory, that's supposed to take care of that. The problem that we have there is that there are no transition fossils. Do we understand what we mean by that? If we're going to go from one species to the next, we would assume that we would have things in between there that would show some kind of a gradual thing. And they are not there. In other words, this is the big thing for today, the missing links are missing. We don't have them. I agree, John. It's annoying. It's pretty annoying. They're missing. We don't have these transition fossils. Now, they have tried to put a whole bunch of things out as transition fossils. You've heard of these, right? I'm not even going to go into a lot of them because now they don't even talk about them anymore, really. I mean, we don't really talk about different, you know, Java man and Neanderthal man and things. You know, we find out, you know, later on that was actually a pig of a tooth. And we find out, all of those things, we find out there's different things. Well, I didn't even realize that there was a theory to explain how come we don't see those things. Clear back since 1972, which I was two then. So by the time I was in college, they should have been telling me that there was another theory that explained why there wasn't transition fossils. Rather than telling me, I wrote down I don't know how many transition fossils in my notebook that they said that existed. And I'm like, oh, yeah, well, I don't know. You know, I mean, I didn't know anything about that. So there's several ones that I did choose that we'd like to put out there that I'm sure you've heard quite a bit about. But before we do that, let's just go back to Charles Darwin's Origin of Species. He says, the number of intermediate varieties which have formerly existed on the earth, I should read this way, must be truly enormous. Why then is not every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediate links? Geology assuredly does not reveal any such finely graduated organic chain. And this, perhaps, is the most obvious and gravest objection which can be urged against my theory. And that's what he said in the book when he wrote it. Now, and I said the other day that I gave another quote, you know, about that if anybody sees any really complex organisms, I would have to reject my theory. Remember Darwin said it, and I said I don't believe that he would. Well, now a lot of time has gone by, and there are no transition fossils. And so, do they take his advice? The theory just, it can't be right. It's gone. No, it's no good. No. We just come up with a different kind of a theory to try to explain that. One of the main ones you've heard is the Archaeopteryx, right? And here's the kind of a fossil of it. I don't know. What is that? I don't know. It looks like it might have some kind of wing thingies or something on there or whatever. And this was, for a long time, was the crossover between reptiles and birds, is what it was. And you know, if you Google Archaeopteryx, you should do it and see how many different pictures. Pictures, is that what they are? They're drawings. And it's just amazing the difference, the variety in that. The variety in the drawing. So I picked two. You know, that one looks a lot more evolutionary. And this one kind of looks like a bird. And since then, the Archaeopteryx, that doesn't get brought up very much anymore. People said it's, well, we think it's a bird. It has some reptilian kind of characteristics on it, but don't a lot of birds? I mean, ever? We used to dress chickens when we were little. This might be kind of gross for some people, but you know, we used to, you know, cut off the claws. You ever taken one of the chicken claw? You feel a chicken claw? If I gave you a chicken claw and had you close your eyes and you felt it, what might you think you'd be feeling? It's very reptilian kind of. You could cut them off and there's a tendon would come out. And I used to chase my sister around pulling the tendon and it would make it go like this. It was great. So, but then she chased me and I fell into the hot water and scalded my backside, which was not a good experience. So, but the Archaeopteryx, you know, it's that we can make drawings on how we want these things to be the whole time. Another one that was my favorite was the coelacanth, because I took a lot of notes on the coelacanth in my class in evolution. I remember trying to draw what his drawing was and stuff, and I, of course, you know, you're a student, you kind of, you know, I made mine with antennas and things, and all kinds of stuff, and I didn't behave very well in that class. But anyway, this coelacanth, which had been extinct for millions, billions, throw whatever you want onto it, some kind of time and stuff, until they found this. Apparently this is a fossil evidence of a scuba diver next to the coelacanth. They started finding coelacanths. They started showing up. And I mean, look at it. I mean, it looks, you know, it looks pretty cool. It's kind of weird looking, you know. And the coelacanth was supposed to be a transition between how life got from the sea onto the tetrapods, is what we call them, how they got onto, they finally walked up on. Notice he has kind of these lobe fins back here. They kind of look like maybe they could be legs, you know, to kind of come out or something onto the, you know. And so we saw fossil evidence of this, and they're not a lot around anymore. So that's what we say they are. They came out, they crawled out. Now we see them, and they're fish. They're swimming. And the people in India are catching them for fun and swimming along with them. Okay? This is what's happened. So we should reject this theory, shouldn't we? Shouldn't we? Come on. Everything you said about the coelacanth was a complete fabrication and not true. Let's reject it. Why don't we reject it? No. We can't. We can't reject it. I cannot admit that God is my creator. I cannot do it. I'm going to come up with something else. Here's another one. This one hasn't gone extinct, but I thought, what would happen if this thing had gone extinct and they found fossil evidence of it? Have you ever read about the platypus? I just gotta think God was like, this will get him. This is an amazing creature. An amazing creature. And what would happen if this thing would have went extinct and they found fossil evidence of this? How would they have explained? They would have explained it somehow, but how? Is this the thing that's coming out of the water onto the land? Is this the thing that's, you know, is it a bird, a part bird? What is it? The platypus has the bill of a duck. It has the tail of a beaver. It has webbed feet that are almost exactly like the otter. It has hair that is almost exactly like bears. It has claws like a reptile. It lays eggs like a turtle. But it gives milk like a mammal to its babies. It builds a burrow that looks almost identical to a rabbit's burrow. And here's some extra things. You might not know about this. On the back legs, it has these spurs that it can get you with, and it will inject venom into you, exactly like a snake. Did you know that? I should have put another picture. I had this close-up of this venomly-looking It's weird, very weird. And then recently what they discovered, they're studying these things, they saw them swimming under the water, and they closed their eyes and their ears closed up. That's kind of weird, you know, because they're hunting, trying to figure out, find things. And, you know, how do they find stuff? And what they would notice is when they're swimming, they're always going like this all the time. And what they found is that there's electrical sensors, electrochemical cells that are in the beaks that they can kind of like a bat, like echolocate things very, very well. They're not watching or even seeing. What is this thing evolving into? Or what did it evolve from? Maybe we should ask that. What is this? I mean, is this a transition fossil? That's not a fossil. It's a creation. It's a creation. And when you look at this thing, praise God. Praise God. I mean, what else can you do? What else can you say when you see something like this? It's a mixture of all sorts of things. It's a mixture of all kinds of life. And they tried really hard to pretend that they found transitions. They really did. They gave it a really good effort and tried to pretend that they had found different things. And they kind of eventually kind of gave up and they said, let's do a different kind of a theory because this one here we're having problems with. And we got to hold on to our atheistic tendencies. We got to come up with something else. And so they came up with something that is, I think you'll enjoy. And the only reason that it stuck is because of who did it. It was Stephen Jay Gould, the renowned American evolutionist. He says something, we believe it. That's the only reason. I think there's a lot of other scientists who could have postulated this, and it wouldn't have stuck. It just stuck just because of him. And it's called punctuated equilibrium. Short for punk eek, because they thought that was kind of cool or something. A cool term. Kids would like saying punk eek, you know. Life usually is an equilibrium. This is what he wrote in his book, in his paper. Life usually is an equilibrium or stasis and doesn't evolve at all until it encounters a sudden environmental shift, at which point it changes rapidly into a different stable species. This happens so rapidly, in fact, that it leaves no fossil record. No fossil evidence. It happens so quickly, you're never going to see that it happened. What I'm doing. Punctuated equilibrium, which apparently was supposed to be the theory of the time. I was supposed to learn about this in college, and I didn't. Now, obviously, we still have a problem with this, right? And why do they say this? Because all of a sudden, in the fossil record, there's a species. There it is. It's right there. There's nothing that came from it. And there's rock, and then there's life right there. It just happened, and so we say, okay, just right there, there, and there. Not looking at it is that this is the way that they're buried, right? This is the way they were buried in a ginormous flood, right? This is what's happened. I found some statistical pictures on this, which I thought were really interesting. This is because I still don't agree with this, because you look at the time scale, it's still millions and millions of years. But this first set of graphs is what the statistics should show according to Darwin. This is what the predicted statistics would be. So we have basically life forms, number of phyla is what it says there on the y-axis, and then time on the x-axis. And then we have this evolution, more and more life, different kinds of life forms going up on this curve here. And then over here we have time going up, and the morphological distance, kind of the distance between evolutionary pathways, and we get the phylogenetic tree, which I went through really fast yesterday, right? That's what was predicted by Darwinism. This is what the statistics show of our fossil record here. And this is kind of what they're talking about with punctuated equilibrium. Number of life forms and time. What do you see? Boom! Life. Now, they put in that right here, from here to here, they say it's 10 million years. But what do we got here? We have life. Life and then decaying is what we have. That's what the statistics show. And then over here, morphological distance. We don't see a tree here, do you? You see life forms all parallel like this. This is what the statistics show. It's completely different than what the statistics for Darwin predicted. And we should, of course, expect no transition fossils. Why would we expect them? The geologic column is a massive graveyard of life at the time that Noah that at the time of the Noah's flood, right? And it's buried about how you would expect from a massive flood. At the bottom of the column is what evolutionists call the Cambrian explosion. Lots of life happened at this time in history. They just all mysteriously showed up. Another very dangerous theory that I want to go, and then I'm gonna skip a lot of stuff, and we'll save it probably for tomorrow, so that I can end on time. And this is a very dangerous theory, and I want to make sure that we really put this point, because I feel that I could possibly have some brothers in Christ in my history that could go down this track. And this theory of evolution is called theistic evolution. The belief that there is a God, the God who created the material universe and all of life within, and that biological evolution is simply a natural process within that creation. Evolution, according to this view, is simply a tool that God employed to develop human life. There's a lot of people that are going down this. Are those days literal?
Yeah.
Maybe they could be a million years each, and then we could have this process that God has just used evolution to bring this life about, even though God said that He did it in 6 days. And in Exodus we have, in 6 days the universe was made. And Jesus says, in the beginning they were created male and female. Even though all those things are in the Bible, we still have sometimes a feeling of, can't we just get along? I don't want to argue with people. Can't we just take science and can't we take evolution and put it together? Catholic Church has already gone this way. This is the Catholic Church's belief. They've already went this way. Billy Graham's been mentioned several times. Billy Graham was very open to this possibility. We should not be. We should not be. And it doesn't even make sense. If we're going to say that theistic evolution is okay and that those could have all been million years, then okay, so let's do that. In the first million years, what was created? Light. What was created in the fourth million years? The sun. So we had light for a million years before we had the sun. What was created in the third million years? Vegetation, right? What was created in the fourth million years? The sun. So we had vegetation for 3 million years without any light. And so as soon as you go down this path, they got you. You can't explain anything in Genesis 1. In terms of these. A lot of people say, well, yeah, but if you look at Genesis 1, it kind of goes along with the evolutionary pathway. No, it doesn't. It's completely mixed up. What do we have on the fifth day? Birds. That's this one I wanted. They're fish and fowl, but birds, right? What do we have on the sixth day? We have mammals, right? And then humans, right? So we have, in creation, we have birds coming before animals. That's not the way it happened. We have mammals and we have falling out of trees, right? Clumsily. Turning into birds. It doesn't match the evolutionary pathway. It doesn't at all. It's not even close. So we can't jump into this and remove God, remove God, lower man, or lower God down to our state of being. That's what we're trying to do. We're trying to lower man or lower God down to us. And we lower him, and we, in the same way, then lower us. We lower us. We put us even further down. We're animals. We're in the animal kingdom. We have animal survival instincts, and that's it. Let's look at some quotes here real fast here, and I'm probably going to save the demonstration for tomorrow. So, sorry. So, we'll start with a demonstration. See, we'll start and end tomorrow with a demonstration. So, I want to look at some quick, I really wanted to get to this point, though. I want to look at some quotes, some things that have come out of evolution. Okay, because a lot of people say, well, yeah, but it's just a theory, and can it really do any harm? Can rejecting the Almighty Creator and rejecting Jesus Christ do any harm for you? That's all there is harm, if you're going to reject that. So I'm going to just go through some quotes real quick. Looking to the world at no very distant date, what an endless number of the lower races will have been eliminated by the higher civilized races throughout the world. That was Charles Darwin. No rational man cognizant of the facts believes that the average Negro is the equal, still less the superior, of the white man. Thomas Huxley, remember him? Agnostic. Biggest proponent of Darwin. This is what he believed. These lower races, such as the Australian Negroes, are psychologically nearer to the mammals, apes or dogs, than to civilized Europeans. We must therefore assign a totally different value to their lives. Ernst Haeckel. Remember the embryos? Before eugenists and others who are laboring for racial betterment can succeed, they must first clear the way for birth control. Like the advocates of birth control, the eugenists, for instance, are seeking to assist the race toward the elimination of the unfit. The unfit in this case are black people. Okay? Both are seeking a single end, but they lay emphasis upon different methods. We're going to stick with this person just a little bit. Here's her next quote. We propose to hire 3 or 4 colored ministers, preferably with social service backgrounds and with engaging personalities. I'm not going to make a comment. The most successful educational approach to the Negro is through a religious appeal. And we do not want word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population. And the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea if it ever occurs to any of their more rebellious members. And the last thing she said was, the most merciful thing that a large family can do for one of its infant members is to kill it. Anybody know who this is? Margaret Sanger. Who is Margaret Sanger? Founder of Planned Parenthood. Right? Founder of Planned Parenthood. I think it's 14% of the population is black women. 36% of the abortions. 36%. 13 million black people have been killed since 1973. 78% of all abortion clinics from Planned Parenthood are put where? In the black neighborhoods. Don't tell me that it's still, there's not an agenda. Do not tell me that there's not an agenda. It comes right out of this. The differences between the individual races, both in part externally and, of course, also in their inner natures, can be quite enormous, and in fact are so. The gulf between the lowest creature, which can still be styled man, and our highest races is greater than that between the lowest type of man and the highest ape. If nature does not wish that weaker individuals should mate with a stronger, she wishes even less that a superior race should intermingle with an inferior one. Because in such a case, all her efforts throughout hundreds of thousands of years to establish an evolutionary higher stage of being and may thus be rendered futile. What's to prevent us from saying Hitler wasn't right? I mean, that was a genuinely difficult question. You know who that is? Probably. If a person doesn't think there's a God to be accountable to, then what's the point of trying to modify your behavior to keep it within acceptable ranges? That's how I thought, anyway. I always believed the theory of evolution is truth, that we all just came from the slime. When we die, you know, that was it. There's nothing. Nothing at all. Who is that? Jeffrey Dahmer. You know him? Evolution. Yeah, well, I'm over time. I got to finish. We'll maybe mention a little bit more. So, I don't even really like talking about him. I can't. It's so sickening.
He was baptized.
Yeah, that's one of the points. That comment right there in the end was. I'll talk to him more about it later, and I'll mention that, because that's an important story. You know what I love? Natural selection. It's the best thing that ever happened to the earth. Getting rid of all the stupid and weak organisms. Natural selection needs a boost, like me with a shotgun. Eric Harris. You guys know the Columbine shootings? You know that one, don't you? Eric Harris. This is on the day that he killed. Look what's on his shirt. Natural selection. This is what comes out of evolution. When we reject God, this is what comes out. It's evil. That's what comes out. I'm going to stop right there, and I have one more thing I really want to do, but I am over, and I apologize, so you can take your break.